And that probably has an impact on how they interact with certain kinds of technology in hospital settings.
Professor Ellen Balka, founder and director of the Assessment of Technology in Context Design Lab at Simon Fraser University in Canada. We spoke at Campus Radio CJSF in 2004. Today, she's partly retired from teaching and does consulting. Her current project is a simple-to-use system for pharmacists to report and prevent repeats of adverse drug reactions. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org or check our website at wingsradio.org/wordpress. We also share news at facebook.com/wingsradio. Wings thanks our supporters, including your local community radio stations, Suzette Cullen and Genevieve Vaughn, host of a series of Zoom salons at maternalgifteconomymovement.org. That's maternalgifteconomymovement.org. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a national audience produced at a different location every week. Today on Sprouts, we feature an interview with Ken Lee, co-founder of Lotus Foods. This interview is produced by Heartland Stories Radio, a weekly show featuring interviews about the future of food farming and public health. Listen now as host Teresa Marquez introduces Ken Lee.
I am Teresa Marquez, and I'm here today with Ken Lee. Ken, together with his wife Carol Levine, founded Lotus Foods in 1995. They set out to change how the world grows rice, and 25 years later, they actually have moved in that direction. Ken, it's great to talk with you today.
Thank you, Teresa. It's great, as always, to be with you to continue our conversation. And thank you again, of course, for the kind words. I'm really excited to talk with you today.
You know, Ken, you and I know that rice is one of our favorite topics. And for our audience, Lotus Foods, which can be found in many, many grocery stores and also is being used in food service as well, are predominantly rice products. But Lotus also does other foods as well, don't they, Ken? I don't want to leave out the other foods you're doing.
Yeah, so the company actually started with food service because we didn't have the funds to actually put it in fancy packaging. But since we've expanded, well, mainly we've been in natural foods, you know, the Whole Foods and the cooperative type of stores, NCG and Infra and folks like that. But now we've kind of made our way into the mass market, and that's been led by our introduction of rice noodles. So we were lucky to kind of introduce rice ramen noodles, oh, I think probably 6 or 7 years ago, when ramen was trending in the marketplace. And at the same time, gluten-free was happening. And so somehow people have really gravitated to our noodles. And since that time, we've expanded into even more. We have now soba noodles and pho noodles and udon as well. And so, you know, we started as a rice company because we really wanted to do our part to preserve the biodiversity of rice. We just observed that so many heirloom varieties of rice were going by the wayside, and you could only find them maybe in seed banks, not in fields where farmers were growing them, because for many farmers, farming was becoming so unproductive that they had to start searching for these cash crops or listening to, you know, multinational companies tell them how they could grow much bigger yields using these special seeds. So we've kind of gotten ourselves into a bit of a mess. And so we think our message is still relevant by promoting heirloom varieties, but then also adding value to them and making products into them that people resonate with.
Well, we know that a lot of, to quote Wendell Berry, how we eat determines how we're going to use the earth. And it's a profound and simple statement, but when you talk about rice, and you know, so many, half the world, over 3.5 million people, eat rice as a staple probably every day. And a rather large percentage right now of our potable water, a third of our fresh water, is going to rice production. And the other part that I think is important that I learned from you, Ken, is that it's women who are growing the rice, and a lot of them in water for a long time, bending over, so very unsustainable for women's bodies. And I think you learned that when you were in China, didn't you, Ken? You and Carol, when you were traveling, thinking, gee, let's have our own business. And I know that your story is about learning some of these things. Tell us a little bit about what happened when you were in China.
Yeah, so I just wanted to touch a little bit on what you said, because in terms of the importance of rice, because maybe in a country that was largely Eurocentric, you know, having its founding roots and people coming from Europe, where rice wasn't maybe as important. But, you know, if you look on a global basis, more people make their living from rice than anything else that human beings do on the planet. And as you mentioned, more than half the world's population gets more than half of its caloric intake from the consumption of rice. And then you mentioned water. And so rice, because it's grown in flooded fields traditionally, uses more water than the second and third crops combined. And then that bit about women, you know, men have left the farms to seek other forms of employment, leaving women to do all the farming. And so not just the farming, but the food preparation and getting water and taking care of the elderly and taking care of the children. And so that's led to this phrase called the feminization of agriculture, which is not a good development. It suggests the fractured nature of farming for smallholder farmers. And when I say smallholders, those are the farmers that are actually producing the majority of food on the planet. So it's not big ag. I think the what you're alluding to in terms of you know, the toll on women in the fields is more of a not something that we observed in China, although certainly that has its impact. You know, China, like the U.S., has gotten into more of kind of an industrial farming with machinery and automation. But largely in the countries that we explored, once we learned about SRI, the system of rice intensification, we started to travel to countries like Madagascar and Cambodia, Indonesia, India, and Thailand. And that was the common thing that we observed, is smallholder farmers, that means they have small holdings of land. They were out there transplanting rice from a nursery into a production field. And each of these family farmers may only own a hectare, a couple acres of land. And so when you're transplanting by hand, there is all that bending over and standing in, you know, in standing water, flooded fields, which is a very unsanitary condition for women. It makes them susceptible to all kinds of parasites and gynecological problems. And, you know, over the long haul, you can witness elderly women in villages that are just bent over permanently, because all the bending over that they had done and all the lugging of all these seedlings that are larger. And so it takes quite a toll on women because they've been the ones that have been charged with the responsibility to do all these things on the farm. So, you know, the thing with SRI, which we market as more crop per drop, there's now ways to mitigate all of that. So when we say SRI is a method of growing more with less, we say less water, less seeds. And so by using less seeds, what we mean is there's a lot of spacing between the rows. Actually, rice is planted in rows using SRI, and there's more spacing so that you don't crowd your seedlings, and you plant them one seedling at a time. And the seedlings themselves are younger, 8 to 15 days old. And so that means less carrying these seedlings into the field. They just take like a, looks like sod, and they plant one seed at a time. And it looks very sparse. And the common refrain when you talk to farmers, like the pioneers who first started this in their village, they would always get criticized by their neighbors. You know, like, what have you done? Look at your field, looks terrible. There's hardly any seeds in there, and you're going to starve. Your family's not going to do well this year. And then after they see it growing for a while, they see that the wider spacing has caused, you know, access to more nutrients and more photosynthesis. And then eventually you see that there's more tillers and panicles. Those are the arms of in the shoots off the rice plant. And actually this is accounts for much more production, in addition to the fact that you're not flooding the fields. By not flooding the fields, it's more aerobic and more conducive to just healthier plants and roots. So that's kind of how we started observing this this tremendous strain on women. And SRI uses a conical weeder, which is kind of looks like if you look like a manual lawnmower. It's got a handle on it and allows the women to stand straight up instead of bent over to do the weeding. Because when you don't flood a field, yes, it's more aerobic, but you it allows for the weeder to go through to feed the plants with more biomass. But more importantly, it also allows for aeration of the soil, which is conducive for more building better soil.
Well, all the good things that we need to address our global warming issues and climate change. I just want to make sure that SRI, System of Rice Intensification, is what Ken and I have been referring to. And it was developed, wasn't it, by Cornell University?
Well, actually, we were informed about SRI, but actually it was a Jesuit agronomist priest, Father Lalanne, and this was in the 70s in Madagascar. And so he was tasked to go to Madagascar to help farmers alleviate poverty and via better yields on rice. And so he had observed in a field where the water had broken away from the rice paddy how the plant was doing better than the stuff that was underwater. And so he played around with that whole concept and developed the system of rice intensification. I'm trying to think of the phrase, Tefi Sina, and that's Malagasy for, I believe it's improvement of the mind. And so that's really the beautiful part of this is farmers are taught how to grow rice differently. It's not some technology that is owned by someone or some company. Rather, it's just farmers become empowered to grow more using less by changing how they think about growing rice.
You know,
so very, very powerful.
Yeah, very powerful, and also is so much common sense, it seems. And you know, right now when we look at how it is critical that we focus on changing the way we grow food for every reason possible, but change is just in agriculture and in food that we've been observing certainly in our lifetimes and our work in the food industry, Ken, is so difficult. And when you look at a product like rice, the dominant food for, you know, like half the planet, more than half the planet, huge use of resources and trying to change that systematically. How is it going? I guess I'm gonna ask that because, you know, I think it's okay that when something starts out, it's slow. But what do you think the chances are of it ramping up, of it really creating a much more change in the production of rice?
Yeah, so I think this goes right to questions of human nature, inertia. Just think about, you know, for everyone that's listening, how many times have we made a New Year's resolution and then by the time February rolls around, it's in shambles because it's hard to change, let alone changing thousands of years of rice production. I just think it's a difficult thing. And I think an example of that is, I mentioned Father Lalanne in the 70s in Madagascar. That was the 70s. And he really, it took till the turn of the century for people to really start adopting this new way to grow rice. I think it takes a generation or two to flip by and, you know, for new ideas to sink in. And that's really been the case with SRI. So does it have a chance to spread and become the a real thing across the globe? I think so, because since the turn of the century, there's, I think it's now over 62 countries where farmers have adopted this way of growing rice, probably about 25 million farmers, still a drop in the bucket. But what it suggests is the old ways of doing things, where you relied on some multinational company to bring you chemicals, which either supplied by the government in some program or they made some kind of a deal to also plant these special seeds, you know, that you need these chemicals to go with. And what that's led to is soil infertility and then farmer debt that's insurmountable. And so what you see in many of these countries is a increasing rate of suicide by farmers because they don't see a way out of this indebtedness. And so I kind of think of this point in time, it's not just farming. You know, we're trying to come out of COVID, but there's this kind of refrain. People are talking about not going back to normal, but coming back better, right? This whole concept of we need to change out of this whole extractive way of treating everything and actually getting into more systemic ways to think and live so that things are interconnected and make sense. Because otherwise, we're just heading for more and more climate interruption, more and more extreme weather. And if we think this whole refugee situation is bad now, from talking to my folks at Cornell, they're saying there'll be another 2 billion people as climate refugees if we don't get this thing under control. So, you know, the thing with not flooding fields, growing rice in rice paddies, you mitigate the methane emissions. So rice fields that are flooded are the number 3 man-made reason for methane emissions, right behind cows, and fossil fuel extraction is number 1. And so just by changing how we grow rice, not only can farmers better their lives, have more food to produce, more to eat, more to sell, it can also help the planet. And if you look at publications like Project Drawdown, you know, there's 2 of the 100 ideas that we can do to roll back climate change. 2 of them are improve rice cultivation and SRI, and 38 of the 100 ideas that they put forward that human beings already know how to do are agriculture related. So how we grow food and not wasting food is also impactful in terms of rolling back climate change. So I think all these things, you know, that you know, have multiple benefits to them. That's kind of the way we should be moving, is identify these ideas and share them with others so that we can use them kind of as a roadmap. Because I think it's kind of daunting for people to think about, what can I do as an individual to save the planet? Because that's really what's at stake, right? If we don't get a hold of this whole warming of the planet, it's going to be catastrophic for people. And I know people don't like to hear that, and that's not a good way to start a conversation. But since we've already gotten into this conversation, I think it's kind of like this slow car moving towards a cliff.
You're listening to Sprouts Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local radio productions of national interest. Today, you're listening to an interview about the story of sustainable rice produced by Heartland Stories Radio, a weekly radio show exploring food farming and public health. We return now to our interview with Ken Lee.
You know, Ken, I am very curious. We've been talking a little bit about the Cornell as a place where the SRI, they supported it, haven't they, a lot? And what is their involvement with SRI, and what are they doing today? How has that evolved there?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, Cornell is not one kind of monolithic kind of a silo. So there's plenty of folks there that don't support SRI. I think largely if you trace the money, you see a lot of departments being supported by, you know, science-based type of agriculture, where they're doing things with genetic modification or different kind of a chemical type of inputs. And so when we say Cornell, we're referring to what was the Cornell International Institute of Food, Agriculture, and Development. They're the ones who, through Norman Uphoff, I believe, heard about SRI kind of was skeptical himself and said, this sounds too good to be true, and started to investigate. And that's where he was convinced this was a real thing. And I think maybe because Norman was a social scientist, not from the, you know, the ag science type of world, there was a little bit of a, how could that be? It's not coming from our community type of thing. And we've seen that with the International Rice Research Institute, which is the preeminent rice research institute in the world. And they were kind of detractors or non-believers of SRI early on. You look at some of their, the way they talk about things now, they've adopted some of these ideas, like alternate wetting. So this idea where they're not flooding fields all the time as a way to save water and also mitigate against methane. So there, I think there's always a division in academia, and I think some of it has to do with funding. But we continue to stay in touch with those folks who kind of keep us informed about all the developments in SRI worldwide, and that keeps us kind of plugged in. And it also makes us available, aware of, you know, where exciting developments happening in the world where we can consider maybe sourcing rice from.
I really have to, you know, bring this up because you were saying, well, you know, there's these people who are into, quote, into science. I have read a lot about golden rice, and 11 scientists who've worked on it have stood up and said, look, it's not really working, golden rice. It's not stable. And that maybe one of grain out of so many, and they can't even say really how many, might have these vitamin A properties, but that golden rice is actually being touted as this terrific scientific discovery, when in fact it's really not that. And I believe that the public is being misled to thinking that, oh, look at how we're using GMOs to solve a vitamin A deficiency with, quote, golden rice. I'm wondering if whether you've heard any of that kind of, or read any of that kind of science that maybe isn't exactly true about golden rice.
Yeah. So, you know, one of the core tenets of Lotus Foods is we've supporting the biodiversity of rice and supporting heirloom varieties. So I don't really see the need for these types of improvements, so-called improvements. I can't speak as an expert about golden rice, but I know that, you know, this adding different kinds of vitamins was one of the things they were trying to save people from. I think one community where they had a lot of blindness, and they, I don't know if that's vitamin A or vitamin C, or but this was, you know, touted to be a cure. And so they've been working on these improved varieties for, I think, 20, 30 years. And so I think they also have a vested interest in investment go somewhere. But from my viewpoint, we work with smallholder farmers who typically were deficit, food deficit. Well, that means they're so small, they can't produce enough food for themselves. And now we know through SRI, we're buying from these farmers. Why? Because they're no longer food deficit. They're creating more rice on the same small plots of land, and they get to use some of their land for growing other vegetables. So now if you can grow other food that gives you these vitamins that you need that they're supposedly deficient of, they can solve a lot of their problems just by eating other foods than just rice. And, you know, in our case, sell at a premium to a company like Lotus Foods. And that, I think, sounds like a better model than just buying special seeds, which have no connection to the communities themselves. I think the golden rice, I think it's a long grain variety. In some of these, you know, farming communities, they don't eat long grain. And so it just seems, you know, kind of a, what is this a solution for? You know, a lot of times they say, and these are higher yielding, and this is going to be able to feed a growing population. And I guess it depends whose study you're looking at, because the way I see it is we have a poverty problem. We have a distribution problem. We have a food waste problem. But I don't think at this point we have a problem with finding enough food. It's just a matter of, yes, we have to continue to improve farm production in harvest and yields, but I don't think golden rice type of solution is addressing any of this.
You know, Ken, this is 25 years now. I think you've been doing this since 1995. You started, actually, it's been 30 years, haven't you? You started long before you even were able to make Lotus Foods come together. You know, how do you think things might be changing in the food world? Has there an impact from COVID? Has something happened in the last 25 or 30 years that you think, wow, if we could do more of that, or this is working, or this is changing? Do you see any anything insightful that you'd like to share with us?
Yeah, thanks for recognizing how long we've been doing this. Sometimes we feel like we've still just begun, and there's so much work to do. You know, COVID is interesting. It's obviously a terrible thing that's happened to people on the planet. But I think it's also brought about an awareness for people, like, what's really important. And you can see, like, where we used to live, we just sold our house in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area. People are seemingly wanting to move out of the cities and get a little more space, you know, where you can have a backyard. And some people are, because they've been working remotely or they've had the privilege of being able to work remotely, they've moved to the countryside and get where they can still work on the internet, much like we have, having moved here to Northern New York. And so I think people have reconsidered what's really important. And I think looking deeper in terms of what it is, kind of quality of life that they're looking for, I think everyone being sequestered at home, you know, for us from a business standpoint, you know, people were buying more staple foods like rice and rice noodles. And so for us, it's been a great thing because we've probably advanced ourselves 2 or 3 years in terms of, you know, getting into more households, getting introduced into more places. And we hope, you know, some of the messaging around more crop or drop, SRI, will resonate with those folks who are looking to be part of the solution with, you know, when they go to the store and vote with their wallet, if you will, knowing that there's a climate-friendly type of rice that they can support that fits in the mold of, you know, this new buzzword, regenerative, you know, that the way we grow food actually matters, that it actually matters about soil health, and that soil has a tremendous capacity to sequester carbon and, you know, get carbon back in the ground where it started, you know, as fossil fuels and that type of thing. And that, you know, carbon, you know, soil likes carbon and it becomes healthier. And, you know, I think of this adage that I don't know who it's attributed to, but people are talking about what we do to the earth, we do to the people. And what we do to the people, we do to the earth. So there's this symbiosis, you know, this interconnectedness. And I think more, you know, the thing with COVID is if it's caused people to question what it is that they do or what it is that they support can make a difference, then I think that's the would be the silver lining of COVID.
Ken, I love your message of how so much of everything's all connected and you know, what we do to the earth, we do to ourselves. And then also this last 2 years, you're so right. I think you said it so well. We are now looking at what really matters most. And that just, it's a nice contemplation to have. I wanna thank you and Carol for your dedication, for bringing this magical rice to us in the most wonderfully delicious flavors and colors, the black rice, the red rice, and so unique, so delicious. But also for your passion for trying to think about the earth and think about the people and think about the women and put it all together and have a delicious meal. It's all lovely. And just great gratitude to you and Carol for all of the good work that you keep doing.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for all the work that you're doing. It's always nice to talk to you, and thank you for your time.
That's it for Sprouts. You've been listening to an interview with Ken Lee. Sprouts' theme music is Torpedoes on Tuesday by Poison Control Center. Sprouts is a weekly program produced in collaboration with community radio stations and independent producers across the country, bringing you local radio productions of national interest. The program is coordinated and distributed by Pacifica Radio. Thanks to Brian David at Satellite Operations. If you or someone at your station has a radio production that you wish to rebroadcast on Sprouts to showcase it nationally, contact our air traffic controller, Ursula Rudenberg, at ursula@pacifica.org. This week's producer was yours truly, Charlie Knorr. Thank you for listening, and see you next week on Sprouts.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours, it will be ours. Oh, one day, when the war is won, we will be sure, we will be sure. Oh, glory,
glory, glory.
Oh,
glory, glory.
Hands to the heavens, no man, no weapon formed against, yes, glory is destined. Everyday women and men become legends. Sins that go against our skin become blessings. The movement is a rhythm to us.
This is Jeremy Skate, like author of Dirty Wars, and you're listening to KBOO, Portland, 90.7.
Camera activist Betty Lee has captured 30 years of street protests in Portland, from the 1989 demonstration condemning the racist murder of Mullah Gay Tahsirah to the Black Lives Matter protests of 2020. The Old Mole Variety Hour is pleased to offer a large print of your choice of Betty's most iconic photos to 10 lucky donors during KBOO's fall membership drive. Winners will be selected by lottery, and everyone who donates will be eligible. For more details and to see Betty's photos, go to kboo.fm/BETTELEE. Every Monday morning at 9 a.m., the Old Mole Variety Hour gnaws at the roots of our capitalist system with views, reviews, and interviews that you can sink your teeth in.